Slavery constituted the principal backdrop against which whites and blacks encountered one another for over 200 years, from the 1660s to the 1860s. The overwhelming majority of slave owners were white, and the overwhelming majority of slaves, black. There was probably more black-white sex during this period than at any other time thus far in American history. Most of it was unwanted sex, stemming from white males' exploitation of black women, the subject of many pages to come. But what about mutually desired sex, or what I refer to as sexual intimacy? Some commentators insist that there can have been no such thing as sexual intimacy between a black enslaved woman and any white man, a slave owner or overseer, or even a mere stranger, because mutually desired sex requires choice, a power denied to slaves by bondage. According to this view, slavery created an extreme dependency that precluded the possibility of chosen as opposed to unwanted sex. As a result, all of the sex that took place between enslaved women and white men constituted some form of sexual assault. Professor Angela Davis is among those who make this argument. Criticizing the notion that a slave woman could consent to have sex with a master, Davis maintains that there could hardly be a basis for delight, affection, and love, as long as white men, by virtue of their economic position, had unlimited access to black women's bodies. Proponents of this view are right to stress the cruel coerciveness of slavery. While the specifics of bondage varied widely over time and from place to place, the condition itself always endowed masters with despotic personal power over their human property. A vivid illustration of slavery's despotism is State versus Mann, an 1829 decision in which the North Carolina Supreme Court reversed the conviction of a white man who had been prosecuted for criminally assaulting a female slave. John Mann had shot a leased slave named Lydia when, for reasons that are unclear, she ran away from him and refused to stop. Writing for the court, Judge Thomas Ruffin declared that under common law, the intentional wounding of a slave by a master did not rise to the level of a crime. In explaining the court's conclusion, Ruffin described the terrible core of American racial slavery with eloquent, if chilling, clarity. The slave, he observed, was one doomed in his own person and his posterity to live without the capacity to make anything his own, and to toil that another may reap the fruits. Absent legislation, masters should be permitted to discipline slaves in whatever way they saw fit, because Ruffin asserted, "We cannot allow the right of the master to be brought into discussion in the courts of justice. The slave, to remain a slave, must be made sensible that there is no appeal from his master, that his power is in no instance usurped, but is conferred by the laws of man at least, if not by the law of God." It was good policy, Judge Ruffin insisted, for courts to refrain from criminalizing even cruel and unreasonable battery on slaves by their owners, for the only thing that could create the obedience that slavery required was uncontrolled authority over the body. The power of the master, he postulated, must be absolute to render the submission of the slave perfect.